Our next meeting will be on Wednesday next week. It's the only time we'll meet on Wednesday. Normally, it's on Thursday at this period and in this place. The bulletin board was in error in announcing the place as S201, which is my fault because I put up the announcement before I checked with Mrs. Brenner. So I am in her doghouse for a while for not having asked. So it'll be S202 each Thursday. And the persons involved in these presentations are myself, Dr. Pietkorn, Professor Koiner, and Dr. Bertram. The series is consists of a total of 12 presentations. Dr. Bertram will be responsible primarily for describing your relationship to the Armed Forces Commission and what it does for the church and the people in uniform. Dr. Pietkorn will talk about the Army chaplaincy. Professor Koiner will talk about the chaplain and the GI. He has some very interesting experiences to tell about, since he's one of us who was actually at a place where there were shootings. I myself just had to duck Japanese submarines in the Pacific, but was never in any fire in a jeep or a trench or anything of that sort. We lived through a couple of air raids, but you get to the point where you don't even notice air raids. But Professor Koiner was with troops right at the front in Western Europe and has some interesting experiences to tell. My job will be to talk primarily about the Air Force chaplaincy, what we call a character guidance program or moral leadership program, depending upon what service you're in. And then today, to talk about the military establishment as a profession. There's a great deal of misunderstanding on the function of the military in the life of a nation. And part of the difficulty, of course, consists in an unawareness of what kind of social system we live in. Since 1648, we live in the multi-state system, where nations claim a maximum measure of sovereignty and have no international power, generally speaking, to which it appeals to arbitrate some question of its own sovereignty. Even the United Nations is not such an international instrument. No nation was willing to give up any sovereignty when it signed the Charter of the United Nations. As a matter of fact, it is specifically said that the United Nations is an organization of sovereign nations. In the Middle Ages, there was always the papacy to appeal to in certain cases, and most nations at that time respected that office for its international authority and its theological and moral guidance. But in the world in which we live since 1648, we have many nations, each one determined to express its own sovereignty. At the moment, there are 117 of them in the United Nations. China is not a part, so that's at least one more, and the biggest of them all in terms of population. Under the multi-state system, no nation owes allegiance to a higher sovereign authority, nor brooks any interference with its internal and external affairs, except by its own choice and through force submission to the superior power of another state or coalition of states. That's one point. The next point. Living in the multi-state system, we must constantly be aware of the fact that nations relate to each other in terms of power. This is where the pacifist usually goes wrong, believing that somehow you can run a nation the way you run a church, And we are very fortunate in our Lutheran tradition always to make a distinction between the two kingdoms, the one on God's left hand, running the universe and the political order, the kingdom of the right hand being the church, where grace and forgiveness and mercy apply. States deal with each other in terms of power. And every nation in the multi-state system is forever busy trying to increase its own advantages and extend its own power. So you have a very complex situation, which the State Department, for instance, always has to keep in mind, that all of these 117, 18 nations are constantly relating to others in terms of power and are seeking their own advantage. Now, to be sure, the outlook and the cultural climate of a people in a nation may be affected by Christian values, with the result that a government in treating some other people may be less cold and harsh in the application of power than it might otherwise be. Still, it is power that rules between nations. St. Paul, therefore, gives us as the symbol of the nation the sword, not the chalice, but the sword, because this is its job, to maintain order within its own borders and to relate peaceably wherever possible and as long as possible to other nations. Sometimes, of course, communications break down and it is no longer possible to deal peaceably with another nation, and this is when you get war. Every nation wants, as a minimum for itself, security, so that it can pursue its internal life and its external relationships without interference. Our policy, the policy of the United States, extends beyond security toward wanting to establish stability and development. So there are three principles involved in our national policy as our country relates to other nations in terms of power. We want a world order where a nation can be secure, especially our nation, where nations can enjoy a measure of stability so that they can develop, each one in its own way. Now, this has been an American dream since 1776. This is the dynamic behind American foreign policy. It would like to bring to the world security, stability, and development. And of course, in the world where we live today, it runs headlong into another major power, which is determined to create instability and insecurity for the purpose of creating the kind of anarchy and political vacuum into which it can move in order to overtake and to take over, I should say, and to control other nations. And I don't need to tell you what that other power is. It happens to be the Soviet Union. In relating on the basis of power to other nations, there are four types of actions a nation resorts to. Generally, it works through diplomatic channels, and we have a rather large foreign service consisting of people trained in this business of dealing with other nations and other peoples in terms of diplomacy. Sometimes we take economic action. For example, when we felt that we needed the Virgin Islands in the Caribbean area as a matter of national security, we bought them from Denmark as an economic action to solve that problem. Sometimes it takes subversive action. Teddy Roosevelt resorted to subversive action when we took over the Panama Canal area. He felt that we needed a canal at that part, in that part of our hemisphere, and the local people were not too willing to give him the necessary land, so he resorted to subversion and set up a little republic that was a kind of creation of our own, whom we could then induce to agree to sell us the property in order to build the Panama Canal. In the contemporary world, the CIA is the subversive arm of our national power. Now, unfortunately, the word subversive has certain overtones which suggest immorality. This may not necessarily be the case. What is involved is clandestine activity. It would be naive to believe that there's any nation in the world which does not resort to subversive activity. They all do, and especially the big ones, in order to maintain power, their own security. Then finally, of course, there's the military type of action, the kind that we took, for example, against Mexico when we brought Texas into the Union. This is a chapter in our history of which we ought not to be particularly proud, but we did it. We sent an army into Mexico, even took over Mexico City until it was willing to surrender what we call the Lone Star Territory, including parts of Arizona and New Mexico. When a nation works with power, as it always does, there are certain elements that have to be considered in determining the nature and the effect of national power. And I will just mention these as part of the total picture. The power of a nation is determined in part by its geographical position. Canada cannot possibly ever be as strong as the United States because its geographical position is against it. The climate simply is too cold in many parts. The strength of a nation is determined partly by population. Not only the number of people, but the quality of people. And when you see us in the United States very busy today in the field of education, this is part of our way of wanting to increase our national power. To have 200 million people who are well trained in the ways and means of a free way of life is a source of strength, while 200 million illiterate people would be a source of weakness. Economy is a source of strength, naturally. And of course, one of the crucial issues we're living with right now is the whole problem of the gold flow. And if this does not come out right, the consequences could be disastrous for all of us. Then technology contributes to national power. Our nation has the most sophisticated and refined technology in the world, especially now with the computer machines, the IBM machines, so that De Gaulle, of course, complains about American imperialism through technological expansion, and he's quite right about that. A nation's power is determined by its resources. When we discuss the problem of Vietnam today in Southeast Asia, let us always keep in mind that our nation needs 90 critical items, only 11 of which are available to us in sufficient supply here in the Western Hemisphere, which means that 79 others we have to get from other parts of the world. And if those other parts of the world were closed off and these were not available to us, there would be wholesale unemployment and, of course, total disaster, which is part of what the communist conspiracy is proposing to do. The strength of a nation is determined also by its ideology. If it doesn't know where it's going and has no purposes, especially, it is weaker than if it has an articulated program. Then, lastly, the strength of a nation is determined by the military power in being. And I underline in being. Not the military power that might be available in 30, 60 days, but the military power that is in being. We have only half an hour between the time that a missile would leave the Soviet Union and strike our territory. In fact, it's quite likely that that time will be reduced to 3 minutes. So you can't operate in strength if the only military power you have is somewhere still to be created. For that reason, we will have a standing army, a standing air force and navy for a long, long time. Coming now to the military as a profession. Any nation needs a military establishment to reckon with the problems of disorder, of chaos, and confusion. It needs a military establishment also for internal purposes, as witness the riots in Detroit. We had 1,500 advisors in South Vietnam until recent years to help that nation create a military establishment, which is part of the necessary equipment of any nation. Sometimes it is said that because we have a standing army and have had it now for 30 years, that we will drift toward totalitarianism. Well, one of the finest democracies we have in the world is Switzerland, and it has had a standing army long before we ever thought of one. It is a country in which every young man, and I mean every young man, serves in the military. They do not have selective service. They have universal military training. But it is a democracy, so those two are not necessarily contradictory. The function of the military profession is the ordered application of force to the resolution of social problems. I would like to repeat that. The function of the profession of arms is the ordered application of force to the resolution of social problems. When the high school in Little Rock, Arkansas refused to integrate under the Eisenhower administration, in case you're Republican, he sent in the paratroopers to solve a social problem by force, since that seemed to be the only way in which it could be solved. Now, I give you that basic statement because there is so much misunderstanding on the function of the military in a nation. It always reminds me of an old jingle which comes from one of the ancestors of Churchill about 275 years ago. And it goes like this: God and the soldier we adore in time of danger, not before. The danger past and all things righted, God is forgotten and the soldier slighted. Now there is less truth to this now than there was, for instance, when I was attending Washington University back in the 30s. And the ROTC people used to get tomatoes and rotten eggs thrown at them right there in the campus. We're past that particular phase. And still, when you hear some of the debate about Vietnam, you discover how little people understand about the military, as though its only business were killing. This is a very minor item in the total undertaking of the military establishment. Most of its time and most of its energies are directed to other projects. The military is a profession. Let me underline that. That is to say, it is not just a job. For a profession is the kind of job where you use special skills coupled with personal commitment. With personal commitment. No man in uniform, for instance, is ever off duty, really. He can be called at any time of the night or any time of the day because it is part of his commitment to be available when he's needed. Dr. Frank Bowles, who was for some time the president of the College Entrance Examination Board, wrote an article some years ago entitled, "Three Great Callings." He lists them as the clergy, the teaching profession, and the military. All three of these expect a large commitment from the individual. And let me say, if there's any place in the world where you learn to know what it means to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread," it is in the military assembly. Because you have a kind of commitment with a blind date with destiny, shall we say, and you never really know what will happen next. And the soldier says, "Well, regardless of what happens, I will be there, and I will make my contribution." Those of you who will be fortunate enough to go into the chaplaincy will discover that there is a strong compatibility between the ministry and the military profession. Both of them, for instance, heavily leaning on the need to stand by. Both are the guardians of men's crises. And that's why, I guess, in the military establishment down through the ages, there have always been either chaplains, as they have been called since St. Martin of Tours, or religious representatives. In fact, there was a time when troops were normally led by bishops, in part because they were the only people who could read. But they never found it incompatible. There is a compatibility between these two professions. And now I would like to spell out what the commitment is in the military profession, which a person assumes when he enters the military service. Number one, the military establishment always stands on the side of order against anarchy and chaos. Ergo, wherever the social order is threatened, there you will find truth. And I submit this is a major moral consideration. For order is one of the things that God created out of chaos. Now, our enemies in days gone by could be found along certain geographical lines. And the line between anarchy and chaos, or the line between our way of life and that of the Indians, could be determined in terms of longitude and latitude. And so in our history, we built forts. Fort Laramie, Fort Cheyenne, you name them. They were put out there by the military ahead of the families that moved westward in order to provide protection for these families as they were extending the instruments of civilization out into no man's land. For remember, it was families that moved westward in our history. Babies were born, people were married, people were buried on these western treks in the covered wagon as they moved the fabric of civilization into the wilderness and the forest lands of our country. This was a dreadfully monotonous life to a large extent. Let me just give you some idea of what it was like to be in these frontier forts. You got up at sunrise. This, of course, is very fine discipline. For formation, you policed your bed, cleaned up the area, got yourself ready for inspection 25 minutes after reveille. Then there was breakfast, of course, and a parade at 9 o'clock for which you were dressed up. You had to shine the buttons and the shoes and all that sort of thing. Then after that, there was cleanup, repairing. Horses were shoed, wagons repaired, lawn mowed, or whatever else happened to be needed to be done if you were not on guard. Of course, if you were on guard, then you marched back and forth in full dress to see whether you could detect some Indian movement somewhere. Dinner was at 1 o'clock. The afternoon was spent in more repair work and policing up the area. Roll call for retreat came at sunset, and taps sounded at 9:30. And most of these troops really appreciated when they were interrupted in this routine by some call for help, some group of covered wagons being attacked by Indians, because then they had a chance to get out of the fort, move down the trail, and rescue people. today, the line between anarchy and order is not so much a matter of latitude and longitude. We're living in a kind of world where anarchy is the articulated purpose and objective of an ideology which doesn't hesitate to work anywhere, inside America, South America, anywhere that there's some kind of weakness. Communists are busy creating disorder, dissatisfaction, and anarchy. From our history, let me just cite a few cases of how the military works in order to preserve order. And perhaps a good case in point would be the Barbary Pirates, because out of that campaign we got the Marine Corps. And one of you will certainly perhaps be serving with the Marines someday and learn to sing from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. They are an elite group, as you know, and their specific job is to be available immediately for any emergency that rises. Well, here's why they came into being. Back in 1785, when our country was only 9 years old, we had all kinds of trouble with the Barbary pirates coming out of North Africa and capturing our ships and then demanding ransom. For example, they came out into the Atlantic in 1785, captured two of our merchant ships and 21 men, and asked for $80,000 in ransom. Somewhat later, they captured 10 ships, 115 men, and asked for $1 million. If you start a good racket, why not increase it? 9 years later, the demand was $2 million. Then Tripoli, which was one of the centers of this kind of activity, broke an agreement and demanded a lump sum of $250,000 on the spot and $25,000 a year just to keep the peace. Well, this is about the time our government got tired of it, and they sent our most illustrious naval officer, Commodore Stephen Decatur, with a naval squadron of ships to put an end to this kind of nonsense. He stopped in Algiers and settled that thing in a hurry, when it moved on to Tunis and to Tripoli, with the Marines of that time. This was their first experience. And one after the other, he subdued these cities and brought them to terms. So this threat to anarchy, to economic chaos, was ended. Today, the threat, of course, to civic order, the threat to social order throughout the world, is the communist ideology, which specializes in creating anarchy. And presently, we are concentrated in our greatest strength in Vietnam. But let us not forget the Mediterranean area. There are many people who believe that the Mediterranean area is a much more crucial point than South Vietnam, and that may be true. In the Arab-Israeli war, the Russians, of course, were in there stirring heavily, and they got the one thing they wanted, namely to persuade the Turks to let some of their warships out through the Bosphorus into the Mediterranean. So that since that time, our Sixth Fleet also has to watch the Russian ships, in addition to the other problems that it has. This is the first time, and in a sense, NATO has been kind of outflanked by the naval presence of the Soviet Union in the Mediterranean, which is arming the Arabs as fast as possible. And I suppose in President Johnson's discussion with ESCO, he has agreed to supply arms to Israel, which is a good point to tell a little story that presumably came out of the Arab-Israeli war. The Israeli officer saw a man leading a donkey across the desert during the war, and on the donkey was a lady, and he was kind of upset about it. He couldn't figure out why a person would be out during wartime with a donkey in the desert. So he rushed in his weapons carryover there to find out, and he said, "Well, what are you doing here?" "Oh," said the man, "we're on our way to Bethlehem." "Oh, well, what's your name?" "Joseph." "What's your wife's name?" "Mary." "Oh, yeah, I suppose you're on your way to Bethlehem and you'll have a baby and call him Jesus." "No," he said, "what do you think we are, Puerto Rican?" This goes over best in New York. Well, the first point then in the military profession, about the military profession, is this, that it is always on the side of order against anarchy. Secondly, it is perpetually pioneering. And that is no mean contribution to civilization and to culture, even from a moral point of view. It is forever pushing forward the instruments of civilization. Let's just take a few areas. Since we live in St. Louis and have heard of Lewis and Clark, at least we crossed the Lewis and Clark Bridge occasionally to Alton, maybe we should remind ourselves that this expedition was an official undertaking by the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, in order to find out what was west of here, particularly along the Mississippi River, then over along the Columbia River to the Pacific Ocean. This was the Louisiana Territory that we had just got from Napoleon for $15 million. Napoleon was on his way out, as someone suggested, because God was bored with him. We had this big territory. The headquarters of the Louisiana Territory was here, incidentally, in St. Louis, at 2nd and Arsenal, where we have an aeronautical chart center today, which draws the map for the moon and other areas. The general at the headquarters here sent out, General Wilkinson, sent out Captain Meriwether Lewis and Lieutenant William Clark, who spent the years from 1803 to 1806 to explore for the President of the United States the Louisiana Territory. They surveyed it. They had 33 enlisted men with them to help them, and they were led by an Indian squaw, as you know, and prepared an official report for the government, for the President of the United States, which made it possible to provide the families who wanted to move westward with a map, and they could tell what they would run into on their way. Now, this didn't come about accidentally. This is an official military undertaking in the interest of pioneering. Or take the other man after whom Pike speaks his name, Lieutenant Zebulon Pike, who with one sergeant and two corporals and 17 privates was given orders to investigate the Mississippi southward toward New Orleans and make contact with the Osage Indians. And then he was ordered to go west and explore out there, Colorado, in that area. He had himself captured in Colorado by the Spaniards so that he would get a chance to see what they were doing out there in Arizona and New Mexico. And like good prisoners of war, these people escaped and then came back and reported to General Wilkinson at 2nd and Arsenal what they had seen, what this country was like, what was going on. And so we had information on that part of our country. And again, this was a specific military undertaking and made it possible then for families to move westward with some enlightened information. Or take the area of medicine, if you don't like exploration. It was the military which developed penicillin, sulfa drugs, blood plasma, largely because of the need. It was we who had to swallow atabrine tablets all during World War II, many of us getting yellow faces from them in order to fight off malaria. Did you know there is in the Army, in the Surgeon General's Office of the Army, an office called the Office of Preventive Medicine, or Division of Preventive Medicine? It can tell you exactly what bugs are found in what areas of the world, what kind of electricity there are, how many types of snakes there are, so that regardless of where our troops are sent, they have this information available before they go. Whether there is direct current, alternating current, no current, whether there are cockroaches, whether there are bears, or whatever else needs to be known. This office has the job of finding out and keeping current. The conquest of malaria was done by the Army. Major Reed, who was a medical officer, discovered the connection between mosquitoes and malaria. Or take the field of education. The finest language education in the world that goes on today is done by our military services with a school at Monterey, California. If you want to learn Russian, that's the place to go. German, any language, you name it, they've got it. And can really train people in this kind of language. Or one of the little side products that we sometimes overlook today. It is the military establishment today that has taken 100,000 young men from America who are illiterate and is training them in reading, writing, arithmetic to make them literate citizens. 100,000 last year. And this, of course, will be repeated each year. Take the field of science. The rivers and harbors of the United States are under the control of the Army Engineers ever since the days of George Washington. He was an engineer. And he realized that if a nation is going to take care of its harbors and rivers, it better be put under the authority of someone like the Army Engineers. And they're still at it. And think of all the technological fallout that our civilian culture gets from the scientific research production in which the military is engaged. Let me just cite a few items. Anti-knock fuel was developed by the Air Force. Air cooling engine, de-icers, plastic windshield, which we take for granted. These came out of military laboratories because of the need. Third point. So we've talked about the military standing at the frontier between order and anarchy. Perpetually pioneering. Thirdly, always standing by. It is a profession whose job is like that of medicine and of the ministry, to be the guardian of men's crises, just to repeat that phrase. It is emergency for which the military prepares itself. That's why it often has a lot more people in it at a given moment than seem to be necessary. But you see, there may be an emergency. Like the item that came up last night at Loeber Hall on the first floor. The kind of criticism that there were too many Army doctors around Annapolis, Maryland. Well, it may look that way for the moment, but they're there in case they're are a great many wounded from Vietnam coming into Walter Reed Hospital. They can be ordered to Walter Reed Hospital to take care of an emergency. The military doesn't have time to try to argue civilians into doing this. It'll take 2-3 months to get a civilian down there. A military man just gets orders and he goes. He better go. So, if there is anything to stand, the soldier says, "I will stand it. I will be there when the emergency develops." So when there are floods, who goes out and sandbags the river? It's the National Guard, a military officer. When there are storms and the people in the western states are cut off from food and fuel, as the Indians were lately, who's in there? The Air Force is in there, flying in food, hay for the cattle. The Army is in there with the bulldozers opening the road to get that young girl who is about to give birth to a baby to a hospital. These people are available immediately to government. And part of the responsibility of government is to have the resources available in order to meet such emergencies. Of course, there is a lot of dead time in the military service. One old sergeant used to say, "I was in the Army for 20 years and I stood 16 years in line." Yes, that's partly true. There's a lot of dead time. But today, unlike the soldier at the frontier, today, most men make use of this dead time with courses given by USAFI, the United States Armed Forces Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. They're taking extension courses, or Maryland University is all over the world offering its courses, where the military even pays the tuition, most of it. In this dead time, men are still on duty. This is part of their profession. in response to faith in their country and their way of life. Finally, number four. The fourth major contribution and ingredient of the military profession is that of protecting the weak. Now, this sounds somewhat paradoxical because often the military is thought of as this great big monster that just enjoys clobbering things apart. Let me repeat, that takes up a minor part of its time. It exists to protect the weak. And let me give you a few examples. When we got into Naples 1943 during World War II, which is a long time ago, forgive me, it's history for you, I realize, the place was threatened with a typhoid epidemic, and so our troops moved in not with guns but with DDT, and the epidemic never came off. Here was this helpless city whose harbor had been bombed to pieces, both by us and the Germans. Thousands of people would have died helpless, but our first job was to clean up the city and prevent this epidemic. That's one reason we're in South Vietnam. Here were people helpless against the terror brought upon them from the north. 53,142 people perished by deliberate murder from the Viet Cong and North Vietnam. Now, that's a figure you don't hear in much of this, the muddle-headed discussion that goes on today. Take another instance, right after the war between the states. The so-called Freedmen's Bureau was established under Brigadier General Howard, who set about doing the following things for the Negro, helpless and weak as he was. He had no master, he had no property, what should be done? The Freedmen's Bureau provided rations and medical supplies, it arranged for labor contracts, it saw to justice for the Negroes and supervised their education. This is how we got Fisk and Howard and Atlantic University, for example. So that in 9 years, $20 million were spent for the weak and the helpless Negro. Over half of these projects weren't even remotely military. Now, the great operation of which we are proud in the Air Force is one known as Operation Vittles, which took place about 20 years ago when the Soviet Union threatened to cut off, and did cut off, the city of Berlin to see whether we would react. Here was a whole city of 2.5 million people cut off all at once from its sources of food and fuel. So General LeMay, the Air Force commander in Wiesbaden, got a request from General Clay, who was running the ground troops, asking how much could be flown in, this had never been tried. And General Curtis LeMay promised 45 tons the next day. Actually, the Air Force brought in 80 tons of stuff the next day. But of course, that's peanuts for a large city. What it actually needed was 1,439 tons of food every day. And the Air Force flew in enough materials actually to provide a surplus for 6 months. This is what we flew in every day. No, not every day, for the total operation. 646 tons of flour and wheat. No, this is every day. I'm sorry. It is every day. 1,439 tons a day. This is what we flew in. 646 tons of flour and wheat every day. 126 tons of cereal. 64 tons of fat. 109 tons of meat and fish. After all, there's still Roman Catholics there. 180 tons of dehydrated potatoes. 11 tons of coffee. 24 tons of powdered milk, 3 tons of yeast, 10 tons of cheese, 38 tons of salt, 144 tons of dehydrated vegetables, and 85 tons of sugar. And then the communists gave it up because they realized they weren't getting anywhere. We were using our military establishment to come to the aid of this weak, threatened city. And so I close with a paragraph from one of MacArthur's decisions, in which he has summarized the moral aspect of the military profession. Quote, "The soldier, be he friend or foe, is charged with the protection of the weak and the unarmed. It is the very reason and essence of his being. When he violates this sacred trust, he not only profanes his entire cult, but threatens the very fabric of international society. The traditions of fighting men are long and honorable. They are based on the noblest of human traits, sacrifice." Now, that is the military profession. And I've tried to describe it to you in terms of how it functions within and for a nation, and what it means in terms of moral commitment for the individual who dons the uniform and becomes part of the establishment. Now, as you notice, we've taken this down on tape for anyone who may want to listen to it. Not everybody could be here today, so it will be available down where? Down below here? All right, very, very good. So that anybody who wants to hear it make up can do so. There's a gray sheet of paper floating around on which I should like to have your names as a record of the people who are here. Next week, Wednesday, I want to do the character guidance program, or the moral leadership program, as it is called, in order to indicate what that is all about. I was asked by Dean Zeidler this morning whether those persons whom the faculty did not endorse the last quarter and now meet the requirements are interested in being approved here. Is there anybody of that group here? If not, I'll contact them individually. Any other question on this now? If you are interested in the chaplaincy and you're on the approved list, I hope you're getting busy to fill in your forms and get these things moved forward to the proper headquarters. You better ask me when you get to that point, because there's been a change in the channel. And we go directly to Fifth Army nowadays, rather than locally, if it's the Army. Any questions here, or any comment, discussion? We have about 3 minutes yet. None? Yes, excuse me. Go ahead. Before your ordination, or a little bit before your ordination, to fill out the application for a regular commission as first lieutenant. But you can't send it in before you are ordained. Oh, about a year. Now, if you go on to graduate school, then you may ask for a waiver. Not that it is always granted, a waiver, so that people can wait for this application. But you are expected within a year to make the application, or it will be done. You lose it. And don't lose it. Don't ever lose it. Anything more? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.